Have you ever felt that intense pressure at work to adopt a shiny new software tool, even when you know deep down that your current systems are just a totally tangled mess?
Oh, absolutely. It's like a universal experience now.
Right. You're sitting in a meeting and someone is presenting this gorgeous, futuristic dashboard that promises to, automate all your problems away.
Yeah, and you're just sitting there thinking about how half your team can barely even log into the basic tools you already have.
Exactly. Welcome to the reality of business in 2026.
It is a very specific kind of modern corporate anxiety. I mean, teams are desperate for a magic bullet, but they're building on top of a fundamentally unstable foundation.
Which is dangerous.
Highly dangerous. That instability is what we call technical debt. It's essentially the compounding interest a company pays later for choosing a quick and dirty temporary technology solution today.
Eventually, that debt comes due.
It always does. And when it does, the whole system just grinds to a halt.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because that anxiety is exactly what we are tackling today.
It's a huge topic.
It really is. Our mission for this deep dive is to explore a highly practical guide that was originally aimed at Southern California and Orange County business leaders.
Yeah.
It's titled Technical Debt Audit: How to Decide What to Fix Before Building New Features.
Such an important read.
Yeah, and we want to help you slow down your technology decisions just enough to evaluate the actual risks, ask sharper questions, and avoid those massive projects that look fantastic in a sales pitch but turn into absolute operational nightmares.
Because the timing for this kind of audit is critical right now. In the 2026 landscape, budgets are significantly tighter.
Right. We aren't in that era of free-flowing venture capital anymore.
Not at all. Furthermore, security expectations are just unrelenting. Buyers are finally demanding hard evidence before they trust a vendor's recommendation.
But the internal teams are still feeling the pain.
Exactly. When teams feel a gap in their workflow, whether that's an unmanaged operational risk or missing documentation or just painfully slow software, that discomfort often triggers a panicked, reactive search for a fast fix.
And that panic leads straight into what this framework calls the tool-first fallacy. I mean, to fix technical debt, we first have to understand why companies rush into these terrible decisions in the first place.
Yeah, and it usually boils down to starting with the software rather than the desired business outcome.
Which seems backwards.
Because it is. What's actually happening there is a massive misalignment of focus. Leaders will see a demo for a new AI platform or like a project management suite and immediately ask, how can we use this in our daily operations?
Ah, I see.
That is entirely backwards. They should be looking at their own internal environment first and asking, what specific business process is currently broken? Or what exact customer experience is failing and needs to change?
So you have to define the business outcome first.
Yes, and the specific metric that will prove progress before you even look at systems, vendors, or access rights.
It makes me think of cars. A tool-first decision is like going out and buying this flashy, expensive carbon fiber aerodynamic spoiler for a car that has a failing transmission.
That is a perfect way to put it.
I mean, sure, the spoiler looks incredibly cool sitting in your driveway, and it feels like a tangible upgrade, but it's not going to help the car actually drive down the street.
Not even a little bit.
It's solving a cosmetic problem you don't actually have, while totally ignoring the critical mechanical failure happening under the hood.
Right, that aesthetic upgrade feels like progress to an executive, but
Yeah.
it creates zero functional value. So, to prevent that trap, the source text relentlessly centers on four critical questions every leader just has to ask.
Okay, what are they?
First, what objective evidence supports the recommendation? Second, who internally owns the outcome after the launch is finished?
Got it.
Third, what specific risks must be handled before implementation even starts? And fourth, how will success be measured at the 30, 60, and 90-day marks?
I have to push back here for a second, though.
Fair.
Who owns this and how do we measure success? I mean, these are fundamentally basic business concepts.
They are.
We learn this in introductory management courses. So why are highly paid executives, people with decades of experience, constantly missing them when it comes to technology?
What's fascinating here is that the pressure of 2026 business environments actively works against our common sense.
Really? How so?
Well, when a company is bleeding time or money due to operational inefficiencies, Executives feel this immense, almost suffocating urgency to just do something.
The need for momentum.
Exactly. That desperation for momentum overrides critical thinking. And on top of that, there is a really dangerous psychological reliance on vendor trust rather than objective process.
So they just trust the salesperson.
Yeah. If a salesperson is charismatic, uses the right industry buzzwords, and runs a flawless demo, executives often substitute that warm feeling of trust for rigorous empirical evidence.
So the slick sales pitch and the looming quarterly deadlines essentially distract us from doing our homework.
Pretty much.
That means we have to find a mechanism to force those four golden questions into the conversation, regardless of how charismatic the vendor is.
And the mechanism for that is translating those exact questions into a 2026 vendor scorecard.
Okay, scorecard.
But this cannot be a simple checklist of software features. It has to measure deeper operational realities. Things like capability, implementation quality, security posture, cost transparency, and exit readiness.
Exit readiness is a big one.
Huge. But instead of looking at 10 different metrics at once, let's consider how you evaluate just one of them, cost transparency.
Right.
You don't score a vendor highly just because their initial quote is low. You demand evidence. You ask for a breakdown of hidden maintenance fees, API access charges, and post-launch support costs.
Because if you don't get that evidence, you hit month four of the project and suddenly your budget is blown entirely out of the water.
Exactly.
Which brings up the warning signs. If they can't produce that deep evidence, what are the immediate red flags you should look for when evaluating a partner?
Well, a vague scope of work is a primary indicator of a bad partner. If they cannot define exactly what they are doing, they will inevitably bill you for figuring it out later. Yeah. Another massive liability is the lack of a rollback plan.
A rollback plan meaning, if the new software deployment totally breaks our current system, how do we hit undo and get back to where we were yesterday?
Precisely. If a vendor doesn't have a structured, documented method to revert to your previous state if their deployment fails, they are effectively gambling with your company's operational lifeblood.
That is terrifying. What else?
Other red flags include weak answers on data security, or an inability to clearly describe what the first 90 days of the project look like in practical day-to-day terms.
Which makes total sense. I mean, if they don't know what day 20 looks like, they're just winging it.
Absolutely.
There is a really interesting tactical approach mentioned here for the interview process, too. It says you shouldn't just ask vendors what they can do. You should ask them what they would do first, what they would absolutely avoid doing, and what scenario would actually cause them to pause a project.
Asking what would cause them to pause is a phenomenal psychological test of the vendor's integrity.
Wow, yeah.
The strongest partners in the tech space are the ones who freely acknowledge trade-offs. They will actively narrow a project's scope to ensure quality before expanding it.
So they aren't just yes men.
Right. If a vendor sits in your conference room and claims, "We can do everything all at once with zero risk," they are either actively deceiving you or they fundamentally do not understand the complexity of your IT environment.
It's a huge red flag.
A true partner will say, if we discover that your legacy database isn't structured properly, that is a risk that will cause us to hit the brakes, pause the implementation, and reassess.
And we also have to talk about the nightmare scenario of vendor lock-in.
Oh, vendor lock-in is essentially a hostage situation.
Right.
It happens when a company relies so heavily on a single software provider that transitioning to a competitor becomes financially or technically impossible.
To avoid that hostage situation, the framework insists you ask for data export options and configuration ownership before you even sign a contract.
That's vital.
Meaning, if you decide to leave, can you easily export your raw data in a readable format? Or is it trapped in their proprietary system?
Exactly.
But that makes me wonder, for you listening right now, if you are about to evaluate a new tool and you want to prevent all of this, what do you actually need to prepare before you even sit down for that first vendor consultation?
You must bring a tightly defined set of parameters to the table. You need your primary business goal clearly stated.
Okay, business goal.
You need an exhaustive list of known pain points, an inventory of your current systems, a defined budget range, your timing pressures, and your compliance requirements.
That's quite a list.
It is, but think about the budget range, for instance. If you walk into a vendor consultation without a documented budget ceiling, the vendor will end up driving the conversation. They'll expand the scope and they'll define your needs for you based on what they want to sell.
Which pulls us right back into the tool-first fallacy.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's say you've done the prep work. You have an objective scorecard, You dodged the red flags by asking what they would avoid doing. You secured your data export rights, and your goals are fully documented. You are ready to launch, right?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, because if your internal team dynamics are chaotic, this multi-$1,000 project will die immediately after the kickoff meeting.
Internal alignment is the silent killer of software rollouts.
It really is.
You can have the best vendor in the world, but a successful plan demands 4 specific internal roles.
Okay, break those down for us.
First, an executive sponsor. This is the person with the financial authority to write the checks and remove political blockers.
Right.
Second, a business owner. The person defining the outcomes and ensuring the tool actually serves the company's strategic goals.
Okay, what's third?
Third is a technical owner, the IT professional validating the architecture and the feasibility. And finally, an operational reviewer, the person confirming that the software actually fits into the daily workflow of the ground level staff.
I have to jump in here because in a smaller company or like a scrappy startup, this 4-person matrix feels incredibly top heavy.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah. If I'm running a 20-person operation, I don't have 4 distinct executives to assign to a single software rollout.
Yeah.
Does this framework just fall apart if you don't have enough staff?
No, it doesn't fall apart at all. In a smaller organization, those roles absolutely condense. 1 or 2 people might wear all 4 hats.
Okay.
The critical takeaway isn't the headcount. It is the fact that the responsibilities of those 4 roles must still be visibly assigned and chronologically separated.
But doesn't that just mean one person is rubber stamping their own terrible ideas?
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm the CEO, the technical owner, and the business owner, I'm just agreeing with myself.
That is the exact risk, which is why the framework forces you to document the perspective of each role separately.
Oh, I see.
The person acting as the technical owner needs to consciously switch mindsets and put on their operational reviewer hat. They have to stop asking, does this software integrate smoothly with our servers? And start asking, is this interface going to take my sales team twice as long to input data?
Right, because if those distinct ownership domains aren't defined, the moment friction occurs, everyone just points fingers and momentum stalls.
Exactly.
And a massive part of that ownership involves something no one ever wants to talk about until it's too late. Documentation.
Yes, documentation.
We are talking about decision notes, system architecture diagrams, and access ownership records. The framework is uncompromising that documentation cannot be pushed to the very end of the project as an afterthought. It's a lifeline.
Consider what happens on a Friday night at 11 p.m. when your critical customer portal crashes.
Oh, no.
Right? If the key employee who built the system abruptly quit 2 weeks ago and nothing was documented, your entire business is paralyzed.
That's a disaster.
Building documentation as you go protects the company's operational continuity. It creates an institutional memory that's independent of any single employee or vendor.
That makes a lot of sense.
And for listeners wanting to understand the industry standards for this kind of structural rigor, looking into resources like martinfowler.com for software architecture or osowest.org for security protocols, that provides a tremendous baseline.
Okay, so the internal team is aligned, even if it's just 2 people wearing 4 hats. The vendor is vetted, and we are documenting the architecture as we build. How do you execute the actual rollout without letting it drag on for a year?
This is why the framework relies heavily on a 90-day success plan.
Mayday.
It forces a rigid timeline that prevents a technical debt audit from becoming this open-ended, budget-draining nightmare.
Okay.
The structure is non-negotiable. Days 1 through 30 are dedicated exclusively to clarifying the current state and prioritizing the gaps. Days 31 through 60 are for implementing or piloting the single highest value improvement. And days 61 through 90 are for reviewing those results, documenting lessons learned, and deciding whether to expand or adjust.
It gives leadership a practical off-ramp. You aren't just blindly hoping it works out 9 months down the line.
Exactly.
And during this 90-day rollout, there's a massive emphasis on security. Every single decision now has a security dimension. Even if you're just buying basic marketing email software, you are still dealing with protecting credentials, transferring customer info, and managing analytics access.
You cannot bypass security reviews just because a tool is perceived as low risk or belongs to the HR department.
Right.
The danger of exposed customer data or hijacked administrative privileges is universal. And alongside that security rigor, teams have to confront budget truths.
Yeah, budgets.
The most dangerous trap during rollout is believing that the lowest initial vendor estimate will be the lowest total cost.
Oh, we see that all the time. A company jumps at the lowest bid, but they don't realize what crucial elements were stripped out to make that number look so attractive.
A realistic budget must account for the discovery phase, QA, rigorous security reviews, and crucial post-launch support. If a vendor's estimate mysteriously leaves those out, you will inevitably pay for them later, usually at a massive emergency premium.
The text also outlines some frequent catastrophic mistakes teams make during this rollout phase.
Oh yeah, there are a few.
Like rushing from the initial approval straight into implementation without checking how it impacts other dependencies. Or ignoring user acceptance testing, which is when you actually have the day-to-day staff try to break the software before it goes live, rather than just having IT testing.
That's so calm.
Or over-customizing before validating the core process. But the mistake that really stands out is leaving the old workflows running right beside the new ones.
A classic error.
Here's where it gets really interesting doing that. It's basically like keeping your ex's apartment keys on your keychain while moving in with your new partner. It's just asking for mixed signals and total confusion.
That is brilliant. If you extend that metaphor into the technical reality, keeping both systems running creates fractured truths across your company.
Fractured truths. Tell me more about that.
Well, imagine your sales team is inputting client data into the old legacy dashboard because it's what they're used to, but the finance department is trying to pull revenue reports from the shiny new system.
Oh, man.
Suddenly, the data doesn't match. No one actually knows how much money the company made this month because you have two different systems claiming to be the source of truth.
That sounds chaotic.
It is. You have to commit to the transition and burn the boat, so to speak. Cut off access to the old workflow to force adoption of the new one.
And a lot of times, teams resist that because they are afraid the new system isn't actually better. Which brings up this incredibly recognizable corporate behavior the framework mentions, inventing success after the fact.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of corporate psychology, failing to measure progress objectively is usually driven by ego and the sunk cost fallacy.
Of course.
Progress metrics, whether that is a 20% reduction in customer response time, staying within a 5% budget variance, or hitting a 90% user adoption rate, all of that must be locked in before implementation starts.
Because if you wait until after the software is rolled out and everyone is exhausted, human nature takes over.
Exactly that. If an executive just spent $50,000 in 6 months of their life on a rollout that isn't fixing the core problem, they don't want to admit failure.
No, nobody wants to do that.
So they look for any vanity metric that happened to go up, maybe website clicks increased slightly, and they move the goalposts. They declare the project a victory based on a metric that had nothing to do with their original pain point.
But by defining success on day one, you force intellectual honesty into the entire timeline.
Exactly.
Which leads us perfectly to the practical next step. Throughout all of this analysis, there is one primary directive that serves as your North Star. Document your current state, choose the single most important business outcome you need, and create a short, rigid action plan that assigns ownership, deadlines, and the first measurable checkpoint.
And for those listening who happen to be operating in Southern California or Orange County, the source material notes that Technegian is a consulting team uniquely positioned to help scope this out.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. Whether an organization needs a fundamental technical debt audit, an optimization of their Microsoft 365 environment, or even custom software development, they utilize this exact phased roadmap. It ensures teams know what happens first, who is accountable, and how to define success without moving the goalposts.
So what does this all mean for you, whether you are prepping for a massive multi-department tech migration, or you're just trying to organize your own team's messy software tools, slowing down to audit your tech debt makes you a vital strategic voice in the room.
Without a doubt.
You become the person who stops the panic, demands the objective evidence, forces the ownership matrix, and ultimately protects your company's time and money.
The source really emphasizes measuring success to avoid inventing it after the fact. But think about this. What if the greatest technical debt a company accumulates isn't in its messy software code or its tangled APIs at all?
What do you mean?
What if the real debt lies in the unexamined, fundamentally broken business processes that leadership insists on forcing their new software to accommodate? If your foundational way of doing business is flawed, no software audit in the world, no matter how rigorous, will ever save it.